extra time is exactly how I find out what's going on in the MLS.
Get lost. Get lost.
Maybe this podcast has influenced me a little bit as well.
Everybody up here, every single day, goes into the office, into the laboratory, to try to cook up some great stuff for you guys.
That's why he's here.
Oh, from New York, New York, you are listening to Extra Time. I am Andrew Wiebe with my partners in soccer, Stefano Fusaro, Matt Doyle, David Goss, 18 games down in the MLS Cup playoffs, 10 games to go to crown an MLS Cup champion, 5 teams through. We've got Cincy Philly on deck in the conference semis, 3 more games to go in the first round, 3 game threes Friday through Sunday. Oh, hold on. David Goss, that's a warning for you. No, we're going straight to the yellow card. That's your third of these playoffs. You are off. No hard shake hands.
Get out of here.
No blowing kisses to
you
the viewers or listeners.
Yellow card love.
This is not an expression of
yellow
fondness.
Card love.
You are taunting.
No, I love the fans. Love the fans more than you love the fans. You can't yellow card that.
Do they love you?
And I'm going to explain it to you forcefully. With my love.
I will say that I still have friends in 101, and they did not interpret that routine as a showing of love.
From Matt Miazga.
Really?
Yeah.
Really?
Shocking.
Right?
In that moment.
Because it seemed like in the moment,
right,
after
making
a penalty
about to eliminate his former team,
that it was all love.
It's okay, guys. To me, it seemed like all love.
Yeah.
But I don't actually know that many people from New Jersey. Now, Tom is actually teaching me what New Jersey people. So anger, I thought, was love. That's what I thought.
I'm accustomed on the streets and roads and freeways and whatever these paths.
And like when you sit on the rock.
Yeah, a different expression of love in New Jersey. It is a hand signal.
Yeah.
But it's a little bit more linear. It's a little bit more up and down.
They're telling you you're number one. Weaver.
Yeah,
and
everybody
and
in
yelling,
New Jersey knows.
Great yelling
job merging there. You did a wonderful job merging.
And yelling is the only way to express love.
Yeah.
And to do it forcefully is the only way to express it. So I believe it. And... listen, Matt Miazga, I'm going to do the same thing.
Matt Miazga clearly believes it.
Victor Rivas did not believe it. We'll get to this more because we're breaking down match two of the first round of these best of three series today on the show. Matt Miazga got 3 yellow cards in 2 games. Incredibly, he got 3 yellow cards in 2 phases because he got one in the PK shootout, therefore wasn't given a red card, but it still is a red card basically because he's suspended for the conference semis against Philly, and it's a whole to-do. We'll get into on the
show.
Well,
he suspended on 3 accumulated yellow cards in the round.
Correct.
And that's a new rule because
there was literally more leeway given to Matt Miazga and others in these MLS Cup playoffs. Instead of 2, you get 3.
Yeah. Right. And he only played 2 games.
Correct.
Yeah,
that's the most impressive part.
The new rule is like it's not an automatic red card if you get a yellow card during the game and then during the PK shootout.
Different, they're considered different phases.
3 years ago,
it was and Schlegel.
Right.
Miazga watched that and was like, I could play goalie. Let's start getting yellow cards. Yeah. Let's start throwing out yellow cards. Oh, that is one of the great moments
MLS
in MLS playoff history. NYCFC
precedent.
Orlando. 2021 or 2020?
20, I want to say.
Yeah. One of the great moments ever. And so did the rule change or was it just explained properly?
I've put myself in a tough position here.
Because you're the IR guy.
Yeah, I've been masquerading as a referee expert until now. I don't actually know. I just know what the current laws are. Yeah. And that's the current law.
This is, I'm being honest, this, it's not good enough.
Yeah, it's
for
fair.
Me, it's not a pen.
No,
this is a coming together.
Just another yellow. We're going another yellow
card.
Yeah,
we should give another yellow card.
Well, speaking of not good enough, we'll get to it later in the show. Hernan Losada out in Montreal. Christian Latanzio out in Charlotte. Phil Neville is now the official Timbers head coach. That leaves 8 MLS jobs open. I'm considering the Red Bulls and Fire jobs open, air quotes.
Okay.
They have interim managers in Troy Lesane.
Can I ask?
And Frank Klopas.
Question that will get us off the rails quickly so Maria can settle
it. Yes.
If the 4 of us were each going to get a head coaching job of the openings in MLS, which one would we each have?
This is a great question.
Great.
I'm down to just take us completely off the playoff rails here. What are you taking, Doyle?
I think we need to assign each other like what we
think. Oh, we're assigning.
We think we'll fit.
We're giving.
But you could do who he's taking to.
I think I would take DC United.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, I like that roster, and I love the amount of talent they have coming through the academy, and I love the stadium is just awesome.
And do you connect
To the DC United fans? Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
about the same way Matt Miazga connects with the New York
Red Bulls. You know, my longtime take is that if MLS was going to do like a Jerry West logo type thing for the league, it would be Echeverry with the ball on his left foot and the flowing mullet. Like that would be
one. Perfect. It,
absolutely.
Couldn't be any better. That's the last team I would have expected.
Yeah, true.
I mean, of all the teams,
obvious reasons, that is right?
Not, yeah, obvious reasons.
Steph, where are you going?
Where I was going.
You're packing your bags for...
When you say it that way, it's so much worse to say.
Yeah, don't say it that way.
Foxborough, Massachusetts, and New England.
Here we come. We know
what New England was this year, but you have Carlos Hill on that team. Yeah. And I think when you got that guy already, you're already one step ahead, I think, of the rest of the teams that have openings. So.
Intro press conference at Bar Louie?
Obviously.
Yeah, let's go.
Caitlin Carr, myself, and Callum are legends at Bar Louie already, just so everybody knows. That's the bar right next to Foxborough. Just ask about us. Just ask about us.
I think you'd be Minnesota.
I was already going to be Minnesota. Yeah. Land of Lakes.
Everything.
Yeah, yeah.
Midwest. I think the fan base is fun enough that you would enjoy it.
Yeah.
There's star power there.
No, that was unquestioned. When I saw the list, is this boom right there. And obviously, we know where you're going.
Montreal.
Yeah,
for sure. We're going to play young players. My average starting age is going to be 16 and a half. And then I'm just going to go eat like a bunch of good food.
What do you do after year one, though, when you get canned?
Then I probably...
Call up Corey.
I'll probably be an assistant coach in Columbus, win a bunch of games.
Yeah.
Or he'll just stay in Montreal forever and just stay there.
Yeah, true.
Never come
back. I mean, it's Canada, so I'm assuming I get paid out for like ever, and I've got healthcare and all that stuff already, too.
All right, let's get into the playoffs. Of course, there are three games left in the first round, all decisive game threes. The first one Friday night, 10 p.m. Eastern, Seattle hosting Dallas. And then on Saturday at 6 p.m. Eastern time, Houston hosting RSL, and then Sunday at 7 p.m. Eastern, the Crew hosting Atlanta United. That'll take us the international break. Then it's the conference semis, conference finals, MLS Cup on the other side. As I said, we've gone through 18 games. It's been fun. It's been entertaining. There have been a lot of goals, a lot of drama. Only 10 games left to go, and the stakes are only ratcheting up from here on out. I do have to say, no stakes, so to speak, but fun, entertaining. Noche d'Or.
Wow.
Friday night.
Yep.
That's the palate cleanser.
I will be watching
for the playoffs.
That game, absolutely.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, Lionel Messi, how many
like,
goals?
There's a finite amount of Messi games we all have left in our life. And like, I'm going to take every opportunity.
100%.
There is. And also, I've been doing the postmortems, and I went through NYCFCs, and I ended up watching more film on NYCFC down the stretch. Santi Rodriguez, I think Maxi coming back unlock something in Santi that just kept staying unlocked even after Maxi got hurt. So I really enjoyed watching him. I enjoyed watching Moussa Bakrar. I'm still not 100% sure if Bakrar is a guy who can lead the line for an elite team in MLS. But
fine, Gabe Seagal is back.
But he made everybody. But so like, there's a lot of reasons to watch this game. It's fun
for on the NYC too. Like it's you want to watch Julian Fernandez.
Yeah, for sure.
Somebody else you really want to watch. I mean, it's a lot more promising than it was at the beginning of the season with NYC and with all the turnover they had and injuries that they had. You never really got like a good sense of what this team could be now with these new players. So this is a good opportunity to see him.
How many goals does Messi score in his Ballon d'Or celebration friendly Noche d'Or?
I say three.
Who knows?
My assumption is it's going to be like 6-4.
I hope.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's what we all want to see.
Yeah.
It's important for Messi to forget just next season. Like Messi's got some big games next week for Argentina. Yeah. They got Uruguay and Brazil at Brazil in World Cup qualifying. So this is also just important for him to be fit and be ready to go, right?
Sharpening his sword against NYCFC.
Big reason the game is being played.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
All right, best thing we saw, round one, match two. I'll get us started. Took the kids to Red Bull Arena. There is nothing like witnessing playoff soccer in person. Big thank you to Two Nines, Brad the Right Phillips, for hooking us up. Got in the Audi Club, living the high life. Felt like my 15th vacation of the year.
Look at me, Louie.
Free buffet. Mindy was getting a kale salad. The boys were overloading on some soft serve ice cream. First half, Kaylin is like, you know, I spend so much time with him. He feels like my blood relative.
You just
at this point.
Misremember your
did.
Child's name
did,
for Kaylin
yeah.
Carr.
Wow.
I don't really have a way to recover.
That's about
nice.
Right now. Cameron is not a big fan of stadium atmospheres. I think the noise is still something he's getting used to.
He was not a big fan of pregame David. When we saw each other, and I was like, Cameron, what's up? Go Red Bulls. How you doing? And he was like, yeah, I'm going to walk the other direction.
Yeah. They were like, we're pretending to run and frolic that way.
And I was like, you've made a good call.
Anyway, he spent the first half hands over ears. They spent the second half, he and Wyatt, my other son, whipping the towels around their heads, screaming, let's go Red Bulls.
Mm.
And it was super cute. And obviously, you got video. And we're like, oh, that's
nice. You poisoned those poor
children.
But
I was like, you have to stop this now. No offense, Red Bulls fans, but I'm not trying to doom them to a life of potential misery.
Yeah.
So we're going to have to nip that in the bud.
Yeah.
Let's go MLS.
Yeah.
That's more my fan of the league, obviously.
Yeah. Well, the Rob Lowe.
Yeah. Had the Rob Lowe MLS at. Yeah. 100%.
Cameron was wearing an FC Porto jersey.
Yeah. Porto.
And we had he's a big fan of methodology, mm-hmm. obviously.
Then Benfica for Wyatt,
who's obviously a fan of youth development.
Well, you've been hanging around with EG.
Yeah. Clearly.
Well, he would have a Belenenses.
Well, and also Eric Krakauer hit me up in the DMs and was very upset because he's a Sporting fan. And he gave me some recs in Lisbon. So he's like, what happened here? You were supposed to come back with that jersey. But a bunch of Portuguese people did come up in the stadium and were like, what? No. Yeah. No, these two don't mix. How did they get these jerseys?
You guys don't know culture.
Anyway, it was awesome. You know, we're joking about Matt Miazga, but that whole game was just, I mean, you were on the edge of our seats. It just felt, the stakes felt big, and it felt like a playoff match, and the stadium filled in after about the first 15 minutes and was loud and into it, and there were Cincinnati traveling supporters in our section, and a good war of words between some New Jerseyites and said Cincinnati folks. And
they were showing love is what you're saying.
Yeah, that's right. They were telling each other how much they love each other. Correct. So that was the best thing that I saw / experienced.
Respect.
Dave, how about you?
I thought mine was going to be the same. And I was with some people at the game who have listened to the show, so they know this is a segment we do. And as Serge Gomez stepped up to the spot, I said, this is going to be the best thing I saw.
Oh God.
Like, I've watched this guy since he was a kid. He is a phenomenal human being. Like, he scored his professional goal and then was at the Red Bull 2 game the next day to watch as a fan. And he, like, takes pictures with everyone and signs and sits with his family and his friends' families.
Great guy.
Still in the same spot. So I love Serge Gomez, and he's going to be a great player. He's going to be fine. But, like, stepping up in that moment, I was like, this is what the Red Bulls have built, right? They want John Tolkien and Serge Gomez to lead. They have them in a big moment. He's got a chance to seal this. They move to game 3. They have
a shot for sure.
I thought they played well in game 2 outside of Andres Reyes's moment of madness or whatever you want to call it. Turns out it was 2 because then he missed a penalty kick as well.
So wait, what did Serge Gomez do?
He skied it over the crossbar. Yes.
He gave a souvenir to my friends in 101.
Of course. Yeah. That's what he was trying to do, obviously.
Yeah. He's a nice guy.
Yeah.
So that ruined that one, and I don't really have like a better one to come back to. Although Diego Luna putting his away made me feel better overall.
That'll be my best thing. The kids around the league, Bernie Camungo had a huge game for Dallas in the second leg that they won 3-1 convincingly. Diego Luna, huge part of that RSL midfield, whether he's playing now as a 10 in a 3-5-2 underneath two strikers or as he played in game 2, he was sort of an inverted left wing. I think he gets on the ball more when he plays as that sort of inverted left wing in a 4-4-2. Either way, he's really good. Jack McGlynn was immense last night for the Philadelphia Union. I think he had 19 passes into the final third. And when McGlynn hits you with a pass, he hits you in the pocket, man. Like, he just weights a ball absolutely perfectly. Quinn Sullivan was really good starting up top in place of Carranza. Nathan Harriel, very good, starting in place of Kai Wagner, which we'll talk more about in a few. Caleb Wiley was very good for Atlanta in their big win over Columbus. And I thought Duncan McGuire had a tough game 1 against Nashville. I thought he was much better in game 2 against the Oats. Didn't get on the board, but those are all guys who I think we're going to be seeing, not all of them necessarily, but all guys who are on the mix for the Olympic team for the U.S. next summer, which I'm getting more and more hyped about get closer and closer.
Wavy's chair is vibrating.
I can't. Yeah, I've got goosebumps. Yeah.
But it's also just like
Pan Am Games.
Olympics? Oh my God.
Yeah, that's all we've been watching.
For a chunk of the year, it didn't feel like we were going to have any breakout young players who were homegrowns, who came through the academy program. Thought we were going to have some good players, but no one who. But now we're
Noel Buck early was a big story.
Right. Noel Buck and Owen Wolf, but he then, you know, he kind of tapered off after
Chris
the U20s.
But like, I think Jalen Neal, you could have put in that one before.
But
he
none
got
of
hurt.
These teams made the playoffs, yeah, right? And now, now we're in the playoffs, and the most important games of the year, and it's not just guys playing bit parts. It's like Diego Luna is in the engine room. Jack McGlynn is in the engine room, being chance creators. Like Duncan McGuire going up against Walker Zimmerman, Bernie Camungo annihilating Nuhu 1v1, which does not happen, right? Like, these are all guys playing important attacking roles and good teams in the most important games of the year. I love to see it because that is the sign of growth that I want to see from MLS.
So I'm going to take Almiron out of this list because he was older.
Mm-hmm.
At Diego Luna's age, have you ever seen a player have this much usage in the attack in a game like this?
Oh, that's a really good question.
You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
RSL's game goes through him.
Right.
And he's 20.
Yeah.
And Thiago Almada, I guess, would be on that list. But for someone who hasn't already been bought for millions of dollars, I don't know that I've ever seen a player have this level.
I don't think so.
Yeah.
Right? You know, even 20 years ago when Landon Donovan was this age, or 22 years ago when he was this age, he was much lower usage player. He was more of just a second forward rather than a midfield orchestrator. And when the first name that you think of is Landon Donovan, when you're talking about a young domestic player, the kid's in good company. McGlynn is there too, all over the ball. Nico Sakiris next year could join that group. He's like McGlynn. I think he's more of a ball progressor rather than a pure chance creator. He needs to either get better at that or get better defensively to be a full-time starter. But there's starting to be, I don't want to say critical mass, but there's starting to be a good level of productivity from attacking centerpiece type of players, and Diego Luna is the best of them right now.
Speaking of, I don't know the best of the young ones, Steph. Yeah. There might be one better.
Yeah, there is one better.
I mean, of the domestics.
Yeah, fair. No, and to be fair, Diego Luna doesn't look like he's 20 years
Steph's
old.
Steph's Argentine, so
if you, domestic for me, right?
If you come in and say that someone won a World Cup, we won't be impressed, because if it's not an Olympics, we don't care.
It's not. Look, talk about players that make an impact. Atlanta United in game one looked like they looked like a high school team out there against Columbus. It was bad. They weren't on the field. They weren't, their formation was bad. They didn't have any ideas. All of a sudden you drop Thiago Almada into that team and they look like world beaters. They look like a completely different squad. I know they're home. I know, but what it was too, it wasn't just throwing Almada in. It was being able to put on the field, the team that he wanted, that Gonzalo Pineda wanted to see, because in the first one, the ideas just did not work. They did not have a like for like replacement. He comes on, he makes Caleb Wiley have a great game. Saba Lobojanica has an amazing game. Chande Silva looked incredible. Yakimakis is able to do what he did. Talk about players that have an impact. Just
also,
having him on the pitch was incredible.
Shout to Steve Cangelosi, who handled that to perfection.
So
he
good.
Said something about a spidey sense right as it came out, and I was like, you don't plan for that. I don't think he knew the mask was coming.
Where did it come out, the Spider-Man mask that Chande Silva celebrated? Because I tried to watch
it. It looks like a social media ad, or someone who works in social media with Atlanta
handed it to him.
Held it because he's holding, or that person is holding their phone. So I don't know if they just aren't a human being in the 20th century.
I love the celebration. It's an awesome celebration. You just got to finish the next chance after the celebration.
Weeby, don't do that.
Because the finish on the first one is unbelievable. It's like the second one was too easy. He's standing in front of a wide open goal on the six, and you can't miss it, can you? He could.
He clearly did.
Yeah, he clearly did.
But I encourage more Marvel-esque.
Except
masks.
You shouldn't get carded.
I'm of the belief that there should be a level of acceptance in a celebratory moment. That if it doesn't delay the game, if it's a normal part of celebrating and isn't like showing up somebody else or doesn't cross a moral or whatever line, like, we're good with it.
Like,
okay?
Remember the Albert Elise Black Panther celebration?
Oh, yeah.
That was awesome.
Yeah. It was great.
Like, entertain
so he didn't
us.
Get yellow card for that because it was still a fun world.
It was still a fun world. Yeah. It's no longer a fun world.
Yeah.
Almada was awesome.
Yeah.
And it was like the single reason why I couldn't include Aiden Morris on my previous list of it. Even though Aiden Morris had like one of the best passes we'll see in the playoffs, that through ball to Yaya Boa in the second half, and has been a really good player. Almada just ate him alive. And some genius on the show last week predicted a multi-goal Atlanta win. Who do we reckon that was?
I don't listen to this show, so I don't remember that. Personally.
I don't listen to anything you guys say. Yeah. Currently not.
Even right now, as we
speak. But to both your points. Yeah, that's exactly why I give you the love. To both your points on Almada, it's just, I think you saw what stood out to me, and we talked about it in our previews that we did, is the confidence that he's going to hold the ball allows Wiley and Lennon to start their runs earlier, to get higher up the field, allows Saba and Silva to predict the game. And I don't think it meant Almada had to be the creator. It just changed the way they play. The question now for game three, which we will get to, is how do they find the balance between what happened in game one and what happened in game two? Because it's not going to be game two. You're not home. No. You're not in front of that crowd. And by the way, the other part of the last 2 weeks, the one part of this format that is great is there are some awesome atmospheres in MLS. And like, we wouldn't have gotten an RSL home game, which bounces, and I love RSL playoff home games. Red Bull Arena at Mercedes-Benz was like, I'm watching, and my wife's like, where is this game? And I'm like, oh, Atlanta. And she's like, oh, right. And it's like, it just looked huge on TV. So that part's cool.
All right.
Fan of the format. Get the hat for Cameron.
Tell me more.
Get the hat for your son, Caleb.
Yeah, it just says format on the front. Best of
three. No, the number. The number four with four a mat.
Yeah, that's good. No, we gotta find
let's
some.
Let's get a brand going.
We got a textile company behind this one.
Hit up Matt Beisler and ask him if he's got
advice. Oh, speaking of Matt Beisler, actually, Sestanovic was passing out free beers in Kansas City as Sporting, former neighbor of mine, Sestanovic.
No,
we're close like that. Yeah. I waved at him when he ran. Kansas City, man, swept St. Louis. Game one, 4-1. Game two, 2-1 at home. Handle business. One seed, going down. The eight seed moves on. I was trying to do research on this. I was like, what's the last eight seed that got this far? And of course, there are no eight seeds basically ever.
Ever,
so that's,
right.
You know, it's already historic. How did Kansas City do it, Doyle?
They didn't make any mistakes. I won't say any, but they made very few mistakes. And what we saw over the second half, over the last 6 months, is that if you don't make mistakes against St. Louis, they didn't have a real way of consistently breaking you down. And that was reflected in their record. They had that great 5-0 start, and we all remember the types of goals they were scoring in that one. Since then, the rest of the season across all competitions, 13 wins, 17 losses, 5 draws. So they weren't a great team. They had a great season, I think, but the red flags that we saw over the course of this year, they really showed up in the playoffs, and that was chance creation and the amount of chances that they allowed. And when Roman Berkey kind of cooled off around August or so, the writing was really on the wall. Like that first goal, the Ndenbe goal, there are a lot of breakdowns that happen there. Like Blum watching the ball, both center backs getting pulled out to the side, nobody able to get a tackle in. Vasilev doesn't rotate over to protect the top of the box. Because, I mean, to be fair, he shouldn't have had to. Blum should have read what was happening, but like the best central midfielders have that sixth sense to cover for their partners when things are going wrong. So all of that type of scrambling defense, that has been an issue for St. Louis basically all season long, but Roman Berkey stood on his head for the better part of the year as he came off his heater, as he cooled off down the stretch. Other than that 4-0 win or 4-1 win over Kansas City back in September, I want to say it was, like, he didn't have many performances like that anymore. Now, this is not saying that it was Berkey's fault on the goal, but what I'm saying is, like, that's the type of save he made earlier in the season, and that papered over some of the cracks that were apparent if you were really watching the game with a critical eye. And come playoff time, the margins get even tighter, and, you know, it ended up being too tight for this St. Louis team.
I thought the Daniel Shalloway goal was the sort of goal that we had expected in the early season from St. Louis, where it's a long ball into the midfield, it's bouncing around, who's going to win the second ball? It had been St. Louis, and then there was just a desire to be direct, and that Kansas City flipped it on them in this series. They won the second balls. When they did it, they were direct, and the difference, ultimately, I think, is that Kansas City just had a lot more talent.
Yeah.
Like, top-end talent. Daniel Shalloway, Russell, Polito, obviously, Kienda, Tomi didn't even really play a huge part in this.
Can I just make a point on that second goal? Talk about a captain's performance. It comes off a set piece or a corner from St. Louis. Johnny Russell clears the corner, heads it out. St. Louis win possession, knock it back in. Russell clears that one out as well. Now everybody's pushing the lineup, getting to midfield. It's a scrum at midfield. St. Louis just about get on the ball and just about start completing a pass. Russell somehow sticks his foot in to break up that pass. Now it's a loose ball. I forget who got on it for KC, but we'll say it was Tommy or whoever got on it. And Russell now is on his feet, pushing up the right sideline, and he gets the pass in stride, and he ends up getting the secondaries. He got four touches on the ball in that entire sequence. All four of them were absolutely crucial, up to and including the secondary assist, making the goal happen. Nobody, like, Leuven wasn't having that kind of a performance for St. Louis. Klaus was close, right? Klaus, I thought, was awesome in these two games, even though he didn't exactly fill it up. But, like, he was basically the only one who I think was playing with that kind of intensity for this team.
He was the only one, and it's the question that I've asked a couple times coming into it, was like, MLS playoffs are different. Could St. Louis elevate their game? And I thought at Leagues Cup they didn't understand where teams go that next
stage. And in the Open Cup.
And in the Open Cup. And then at times in that second game against KC, in KC, where it was like KC went to another level, just in intensity and pressure and the desire, and then sort of understanding the moments, and St. Louis couldn't get there, and they didn't get there in these two games.
Yeah.
And like, I thought, I guess it was Taylor on the broadcast, spoke to it well, of like when Pompeo came on at halftime, he just pushed Jake Davis.
Yeah.
And like, it was the first time anyone but Klaus had done something that frustrated an SKC player. And I think that's where they'll be upset about this series, was just an inability to have any effect on what SKC was doing until the last 15 or so minutes. And I said it coming out of the first game, I think having Klaus so isolated hurt, because he was the only one effective. And in the second game, they tried and get numbers near him, but they didn't win the ball enough. There's one moment, I think it's Davis plays a poor pass that Stroud intercepts.
Exactly one, yeah.
And that's where I think you're looking forward. You're asking what St. Louis does. If it's someone who's a little bit better on the ball in that moment than Stroud, he tries to play a first-time pass to Dennerin over the top. That's St. Louis's moment.
Yep.
They force a turnover. They're in their mid-block.
It was the one time that Sporting KC allowed space in behind.
Yeah, and it was there, and he mishit the pass.
Yeah,
and they had more opportunities like that in the beginning of the season, so it wasn't one chance and then you're done, but they were never able to create moments like that.
Well, in the beginning of the season, teams, managers, everyone was sort of caught by surprise, I think. That's the first five games where it was like, why are players passing the ball to João Klaus here?
Caught by surprise of Bradley Carnell.
No, I get it, but I think it's more in the sense of we came out of preseason.
Why are you wearing that jersey?
The St. Louis jersey?
Yeah.
All right. Was I? Am I?
I literally, I don't listen to you. I also don't look at what you wear.
You
and I
this?
Just noticed.
It's a nice jersey. I like the pinstripes.
Okay.
The whole thing, too, you're talking about Bradley Carnell. Earlier in the season, Vermees under pressure, when they were just not getting it done early in the season, he comes in. I feel like he put on a masterclass against a team in St. Louis that doesn't have the experience. Bradley Carnell is a coach that has experience, but maybe not at this level. Vermees has been here, done it before. I feel like that you really did see that difference, especially from a manager that kind of been there, done that, and has, like I said, was also under pressure earlier this season. Didn't faze them, and now they're here and get a big win.
And I would say, and I know you slightly disagree on this, but in game one, Vermees stuck to his guns, not just in game one, but like from a year ago. Right, what Peter Vermees did this year was like, this is what I thought about Logan Ndembe and Remy Voltaire and this roster if it's together.
Right.
And he stuck to it all year. He didn't make emergency moves in the summer. He was like, if we're healthy, we're good. And in game one, while he slightly changed things to get Russell some rest, whatever, he stuck to what they did, where Carnell moved away from it just a little bit to adjust to an opponent. And I don't think it worked out for them. And I think that's where you look at that experience of Vermees is like, I don't care.
Right.
I know I'm here. This is my club. I'm going to do what I want. I'm going to run this team the way I want because I have success in the past and I know it works.
I also just think there's a huge difference between being like, are we going to play Sam Adinerin or not? Credit to Sam Adinerin, who had a great season, who came in when he wasn't part of the plans.
We can't and the rewrite history.
I know. And the difference between the options that Peter Vermees had within the personnel on his team. He just had more options
because
he has better players.
Gaudikindah has not been good this year. Gaudikindah has not been good.
St. Louis don't have a Gaudikindah, Dave. They don't have any attacking players in the midfield.
Indy Vasilev performed better this year than Gaudikindah.
Is Vasilev a better player than Gaudikindah?
You can't do an abstract thing. They're based off the body of work that we're coming out of.
The body of work doesn't matter when you hit one playoff game. Well, it doesn't. Who's the better player? Who's going to perform in the moment?
It's supposed to be three games.
Well, the first, okay, fine. Two games, whatever it was.
Isn't Ricky Pooj the best player? Why aren't the Galaxy here? Oh, it's not an abstract conversation.
Well, because I just told you, Kansas City has volume of better players by a significant degree. A very significant degree. Klaus, Berkey, and Leuven. Those are three pretty high-level players, or perhaps in our best 11 conversation players
in this
league.
Over the last 12 months, the players on St. Louis roster have outperformed the SKC.
No, uh-uh. Over the course of a month and a half at the start of the season, St. Louis was awesome. But since then, KC has been a better team.
But not all these players have performed.
St. Louis would bite their own hands off to get Daniel Shawi. They don't have a single player on that roster that can change games the way Daniel Shawi can in that position.
Oh, in that position.
Johnny Russell, same.
Not.
Eric Tommy, overall. Same. Okay. Gaudikindah, same. Alan Pleto, same.
I understand your point, and all of these guys cost more money. That's why. But I think that it's unfair.
It's a salary cap league. You can choose to spend the money.
For sure. But I think it's unfair to say that this player is better based off our opinion of like how they touch a soccer ball when like over the course of the year they were worse soccer players.
But were they? Because it was the full year. Were they really worse as soccer players? Because like
the first 10 games.
First 10 games.
Yes.
Yes. But then since then, and look at his credits kind of put a bow on it. It's like credit to all those players that if I would have told you Alan Pulido wouldn't score a goal in this series and Kansas City would advance, would you believe me? Because
yeah. Well, if you told me he had three assists, I would say, yeah, probably.
Fine, fair. But like he's been the goal scorer for them the majority of the season. So that'd be the guy. You know what I mean? Obviously, he still played a big role in the game. But these guys all showed out in the moment where it most mattered, and they continue to get better throughout the entire season.
And to contextualize it, we've talked a lot about St. Louis's hot start, which we should. That is part of the year, and this was a successful year, hands down, for St. Louis. Also part of the year was Johnny Russell missing the first 5-6 games for Sporting KC. Pulido not coming back until May. Who else?
I mean, like Gaudikindah was out for a full season, too.
Was out for a full season, didn't come back.
Tim Melia was hurt to start the season. It was Kendall McIntosh.
Danny Rosero, who was huge for this team, broke his nose in this one, by the way. He didn't become a starter locked in until, I think, game 8. So
Bedoya had issues being healthy.
So, basically, Peter Vermees flipped more than half his starting lineup after that first 10-game stretch. And what he said on Decision Day was, it's not like I forgot how to coach. I just didn't have my guys. He got his guys back. They averaged 1.7, 1.8 points per game over the final 24 games of the season, which would have topped the Western Conference. They went into the playoffs playing better soccer than St. Louis had, and they were clearly the better team.
Can I say this, too, and we'll put a bow on all this conversation? I also want to give credit to Kansas City and Peter Vermees because we've complained about the youth side of this, of like developing and blooding and actually relying upon younger players. It's like, well, it's going to be Graham Zusi. Oh, no, Roger. Like, but Jake Davis and Logan Ndimbe came on and became high-level outside
backs.
They're
a huge part of the way the team plays.
100%.
Their ability to play through them or control
possession. It looks like every minute on the field playing against Jake Davis looks miserable. He just makes people miserable.
Well, and the story with Jake Davis is that was always the story. He just overdid it, and Peter Vermees was like, you gotta choose your moments, dude. You can't go 1,000 miles per hour all the time.
The Sporting KC
reined him in.
Just awful to
if
be around.
I could play half the passes in his arsenal, no, that's I would be, pl- I'm I would not be saying, playing in Charleston. As
he's not year. Like he's not just an irritant, but like he has that Sporting KC.
It's sad to have. Let's put a bow on this one. Logan Ndimbe tore his ACL in
this
game.
Fourth bow we've put on.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of bows.
A lot of bows.
He's ready for the holidays.
Yeah. I don't know. They said he played 40 minutes with the torn ACL. I know there are different degrees, different ways that you can tear it, but that seems pretty nutty.
He's awesome. And he's been massive for them.
He's a breakout player in these playoffs.
Yeah. And they, I think credit to what you talk about development with Vermees, he actually started getting him minutes this year as a winger at times while they had injuries, I think got him comfortable on the field. And then you start to pull him back where there's more pressure because you can't lose battles.
Yeah.
You have to understand your position, especially with Fontas next to you. And I think that's been a big part of KC going forward. So,
hold on, Dave.
Shout out to Graham Zusi and Roger Espinosa. Come on down.
Do you think Kansas City can make a run at MLS Cup, Dave? They have to go on the road now in the conference semis, conference finals, and MLS Cup.
Yeah, single elimination. They're there. They're already on the road. Like, do you think that's a ridiculous question that you're asking?
No. I'm truly curious.
Do you think so? Yes. Especially because we don't know. I think Houston fits, even though Houston's going to be home and they're good at home, it fits their game model.
Oh, like, it'll be Houston. Houston advanced already?
No, I'm saying if they do.
Okay.
And then on the other side, RSL, that's like, is Chicho healthy? Is Palacio healthy? Like, there's a lot of question marks on RSL. So I think they like their matchups. I think, by the way, this is why everyone was like, Peter Vermees should not be celebrating that he got into the playoffs as an 8 seed. And I think Peter Vermees was like, I'm 4 games away from a conference final.
Yeah.
And now he's 1 game away from a conference final because he kind of thought this was possible.
Let's put a bow
on another
on St. Louis City's season. We'll try to do this for every team eliminated. Steph, was this a successful season? To what degree? And what's the lasting memory from year one for St. Louis?
Super impressive, incredible for an expansion team to have this much success. I think it is a successful season when you kind of, you know, put everything into a vacuum. There are some people that are going to say, oh, well, it's a disappointing end. So it's not, you know, there's no trophies. So it's not. Look, I think the job that they did putting this team together, what Bradley Carnell did to get the most out of these players that just came together at the beginning of the season, I think you have to applaud it. They were fun to watch. The atmosphere was great in that stadium. And I think that they created a fan base that is really going to be around for a very long time and really push that team forward. So, yeah, I think it's a success.
Yeah, you might say they invented creating a fan base to push this team forward for a very long time. That's the part that I think is outside of the obvious, which are the results. I mean, the points record for an expansion team in the regular season, that's incredible. The style of play that they immediately were able to
tied the points record.
Oh, they tied it?
Yeah, they didn't set it, I think.
I thought they set it.
No, they were on track to, but then they took like 1 point from their final 3 games.
That's tough.
Either way.
All the memories, I mean, that those fans made this year,
we're going to start playing graduation.
Looked amazing.
For you?
Yeah, we can do that. but we cannot, like, try to brush over the fact that getting swept by your rival in year one of the playoffs and getting beat down in doing so is not a huge disappointment and a terribly sour taste in your mouth at the end. There's no doubt.
For sure, but as a neutral, it's actually fantastic because now next year the storyline is just right.
It has a very Galaxy LAFC of like LAFC did everything but couldn't beat the Galaxy. Red Bulls beat NYCFC fairly consistently at the beginning. It has a little bit of that vibe. I don't really know where you were trying to go with that, but I think if you tie the points record for an expansion
team. They
didn't
tie it.
I thought you just said they tied it.
I was wrong.
They won?
LAFC had the record, 57 points in 2018. St. Louis was 56.
Got it. Okay. One away.
What they became is the first expansion team to win a regular season conference title.
Yeah. Got it.
If you do all of that, they give away CONCACAF Champions Cup spots, right?
They do.
So they have qualified for in year one. That's a pretty good thing to do.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. When Messi did it, it was super important, but St. Louis does it.
Well, to be fair, Messi did it by winning it.
I just think from a neutral perspective, this is the best possible season that you could have hoped for because they were a real team right off the jump, even though we were all wrong with our preseason prediction of what they would be. They have a defined style. Carnell did a great job of developing the young kids. I think they hit on most of the big signings, though Joachim Nielsen, he has to be better next year. And then we get this kind of devastating ending that lights a match on this rivalry that is already like one of the best rivalry, because like every single game, those stadiums, the way they looked, the way they sounded, the way players on both sides, well, Sporting Kansas City did not show up for the first game, and that actually, I think, helped set the stage as well. I'm already looking forward to it. And as David said, they're in CONCACAF Champions Cup. If you had offered this at the start of the year for St. Louis. It is 1,000% a successful season.
I mean, they've been a perfect addition to MLS in every way. In every way.
Even with the pinstripes. I like the pinstripes.
I know. I feel like they didn't wear this jersey enough. Stuck with the city red. Vancouver Whitecaps,
really,
by the way.
Shows off your tan.
You like it? Yeah. Vancouver Whitecaps, LAFC. LAFC defending champions, swept
it's like
the series.
The table extends up on this chair.
I'm feeling like 5 inches. I got 5 inches taller right now. I'm tan? Oh my gosh. Oh, I think 3 out of 4 at the table. I don't know if, Steph, you were involved in this. I don't want to loop you in. Picked Vancouver to win this series?
I definitely did.
I'm pretty sure I did. Didn't happen.
That's like whether I was here or not, I was correct.
Yeah.
LAFC 1-0 winners in match 2, a record crowd of Vancouver. They opened the upper bowl at BC Place for the first time in their history. 30,000 plus packed in to see Vancouver not really impress and sort of be bogged down in the final third, which was a huge bummer. It was a contentious PK decision that sort of decided at least the goal in this game. Mario Gonzalez going down and Tim Ford pointing to the spot, and the Vancouver Whitecaps didn't like that. And then Vinny Sartini didn't like a lot of other stuff at the end, including a potential pick by the referee, unintentional, obviously. And that goal that was scored was called off correctly, but Vinny Sartini lost it. I mean, absolutely lost it. Was going crazy on the field, went crazy in his presser, made some comments that were highly, highly inappropriate. He clearly realized that quickly and apologized for them as well. This was a crazy 1-0 game that I still am bummed for Vancouver about, because they had an opportunity in front of that fan base to do something really special and just couldn't quite get over that line.
No, I think what I talked about with St. Louis of like just understanding the next step of how the game is played at a higher intensity level. Vancouver are a team that I think out effort and out energy a lot of teams in MLS regular season. And then they didn't understand how to push that in the playoffs. And so you have this record crowd and it's just, this is a team that plays direct and puts you under pressure and makes you make bad decisions on Richie Larea tackles because you've had to defend a couple times and you're scrambling. Not a single moment of this game was scrambling outside of like one Ali Ahmed cross that he was able to get in. And we talked about set piece defending last time. Multiple Vancouver corner kicks led to LAFC breakouts. And there was not, except for one set piece, there was not a single dangerous moment from set pieces for a Vancouver team that has a ton of aerial threats, played 3 center backs in this game. Sam Adekube, who plays as a center back for Canada and has Brian White, and they have the quality of service that they have. So it just felt like every little facet of the game where I think a lot of us felt, oh, Vancouver has an advantage here. This is how Vancouver can beat LAFC. Vancouver underperformed themselves, and then you give credit to LAFC for setting it up. And then the penalty kick, I think it's the wrong call. And then after that, Vancouver is like sits off. And LAFC is knocking it around the back, and it's the Vancouver fans are booing LAFC for passing when there's no pressure in them. And it just felt like the team as a whole didn't understand what was going on and how to react to the situation and how to move on from there. And so it's really unfortunate because it's a few years for Vancouver where we think we see improvement and we think they're ready to take the next step, and they don't. And you can apologize for some of it.
They took the next step this year, though. They played actual good ball. They won Canadian championship.
They won the Canadian championship last year.
Not fair, but I thought, okay, so they defended their Canadian championship and they won Cascadia Cup. And they, I mean, most importantly, is down the stretch in September when they had 7 straight on the road. And we thought, like, okay, they're done. They started playing better than ever for half of it, which was enough. And they came in and they gave us enough reason, idiots like us, enough reason to think, like, yeah, they could be the defending champs. We did see the gap, right? In LAFC's ability to shut the game down. I thought LAFC over 2 legs, that's the most impressive team that I've seen in these playoffs so far. They look like the champions again. Like, Vancouver don't have that. The other thing Vancouver don't have, this series was an example of why I struggled to put Pedro Vite into the top 15 for 22 under 22, because he's a nice little player and he's clean on the ball. But like, there were times where I wanted him to be more aggressive, first about getting on the ball, and second about breaking lines when he does. And there wasn't enough of that. And like, credit to LAFC, because I think a lot of that was...
Yeah, especially Kellen.
Kellen in the second game. But like, if you're going to be one of the best playmakers in the league, you need to be able to handle your business in that part of the field in the biggest games. And Pedro Vite's not there yet. And to me, I think it's the same thing as St. Louis City. If you had offered this season to Vancouver fans, even with the painful ending, if you had offered this season to Vancouver fans before 2023 started, they would have grabbed it with two hands. And what is going to define 2024, whether it's successful or not, get another center back. I know David loves that.
Yeah.
Get another center back.
Teams in MLS don't have enough depth in that position.
No, and I heard that the Dolphins are going to sign five Hall of Fame quarterbacks because that'll have, give you depth just in case.
And Vite.
Should we sign LeBron?
Pedro Vite needs to take the next step as a midfield orchestrator, because when he does that, then Ryan Gold can just be a second forward. He doesn't have to drop in and become an orchestrator. And in this one, he had to drop in a lot. Part of that was like, okay, we'll grow into a double pivot to protect against Bawanga, because Bawanga cutting inside just annihilated the poor center backs in the first.
Which game. I mean, which worked.
It did. He was quieter, but like that just makes it that much more important for Vite to be a difference maker with the ball, because like if you're going to crowd the central midfield, then your central midfielders have to ball out. He didn't.
They have an open DP spot now.
Well, it's Vite or. Do they choose to upgrade in that position? That is the obvious position where they've already spent.
We know that the Caps aren't going to go out and buy a player. Because like to buy a player who's better than Pedro Vite, you're spending $5 or $6 million. And I don't think the Caps are going out and spending that.
Yeah, maybe. I mean,
I like this team. And I think Pedro Vite has like two more levels he can hit. I say run it back. You know, like bring this team back. I had so much fun watching next to it. And it's like, get better at set pieces. If you can add a high level, like Xavier Arriaga is going to be traded this year. If you can get him, get Xavier Arriaga, and then like make sure that Vite has an off-season regimen and is crushing film so that he could come back and be the type of guy who is one of the best players on the field in a game like this.
There's also an element of Vanni Sartini seems to have figured out the way he wants to play. Formationally, personnel-wise, and that was a big question mark until he sort of found the Gold-White free-running pairing up top with the wingbacks.
I'm afraid that you're going to jinx it by putting it into the world.
Yeah, we'll just back that right up.
Every transfer window, Vanny changes his game up.
It's also the least shocking thing that all you guys picked Vancouver to win, because let's be real, it's like the neutral team.
A bunch of hipsters.
I mean, because how many, and I include myself in this.
No sleep, still Brooklyn over here.
I know.
How many fun... like late night MLS sicko games did we get in Vancouver that just brings so much joy to guys like us?
Well, it used to be a meme, because it used to be like, oh God, Vancouver late night. It's the worst thing. But like this year,
in the last like 2 years,
I think,
it's fun.
It's been a lot of fun. Yeah. True MLS after dark stuff.
I love it.
The other thing I've mentioned throughout is Sam Adekube's either been hurt or really bad, and I thought he was bad again in this game. And I like the idea of swapping players on the wings, because defenders sort of, you get into a comfort zone with your battle, and then now all of a sudden Richie's on your side and Sam's, but Adekube can't go to his right foot, so he had to come inside and play into feet every single time. I thought it hurt Vancouver's attack, and I don't think he put in a single cross from the left side. Maybe there was one late, but it's like, that's a huge part of your game model. You have two guys inside, you have Brian White, and they never really found that. And I thought both the wingbacks were underwhelming.
Yeah, Larea got pulled early, and Sartini said it was performance.
Yeah, and so if you're going to invest at that level, at that position, they have to be difference makers, and they weren't in this game. They weren't at all in this series.
Doyle, unpack for me a little bit before we move on. Just LAFC, the team that's impressed you most. Denny Bawanga, I know, didn't have a vintage game, but he got another goal. He's on 36 in all comps, two behind Carlos Vela's overall MLS record in that regard. LAFC, to me, feel like a team that was like, hey, I don't know how y'all forgot about us, but we've had probably the highest peak in the entire league this season. Mm-hmm. We just couldn't get it over the line in the biggest moments. But, oh, by the way, we have a ton of playoff, single game, like, must-win sweat this year and last year, and we might go win this thing again.
Yeah, that's... basically what I was going to say.
Well, that was a bad question.
Yeah. So, no, they're just very good at locking things down and not letting you play. And not in a Red Bulls type of way where they're, it's all murder ball, but like where they're just like really, really well structured. The gaps between their lines are very tight. And then Ilie is so quick at moving the ball into, like, he's not going to play a 60-yard through ball, but he moves the ball into good spots really quickly that put LAFC into situations where they have the advantage they want. They have the 2v1 on the outside, and you're pulling your center back out, and then Bwanga's ducking inside and making a direct goal scoring run off the ball. And it's like, that's tough. That's just like a tough pattern to play. And oh yeah, they've remembered how to be like just awesome on set pieces again. And when you have you don't give up good chances, and you have patterns that allow you to generate pretty good chances from open play, and you dominate on set, like, there's a reason they won MLS Cup last year.
And often when we talk about playoffs, which I think this year with a new format, we weren't sure how it would sort of fall, but often if you have the best player on the field, you'll lean towards him. Bwanga was so clearly the most dangerous player in this series. Yeah. Again, multiple Vancouver corner kicks led to LAFC breakouts because Bwanga is a terror anytime you open the field up. He feels goal dangerous every time he touches the ball. Vancouver, there's no one else in the West like that. Almada is probably similar. Cucho, probably Lucho Acosta. There are guys in the East, but in the West, there's no one else left as good as him or as dangerous.
I made the comparison the night we were watching the game and getting ready for it of him being like an elite NBA scorer, in the sense that he has spots, and if he gets to his spots, you're basically cooked before you've got there.
Yeah.
And it feels like that right now. Like, if you let him get on his right foot driving inside, you're done.
Yeah, that's the goal in the first game was just every center back or every defender was too far away, where he got to full speed coming inside on his right
foot. He gets the full speed. He ran the length of the field to tell Mateo Bogusz, you can't have this breakaway goal because I need it in the 97th minute of the match.
I think Mario...
and was offside. He didn't get... He overran it.
I think Mario Gonzalez, after the... I think he didn't understand why the goal was called off. And after, because there was after the game, you saw him and Mario Gonzalez talking, and there was like ones and twos being discussed.
Right. One, there's
one defender,
the second to last defender.
Because he was like, I was behind the defender. I scored that goal. I've done that a million times in my life.
It's like, well, and they were like, Takeoka was up the other side of the field, buddy.
That is, by the way, one of the best calls in soccer. It happened in Mexico at the 2010 World Cup in the opening game against South Africa. And I love that.
Maxime Crepeau is back too. So.
Is one thing I'll say about LAFC, and 100% they looked probably the best team here in the first round so far of all the teams that we've watched play. Offensively, are they too dependent on Bwanga? And is there a team that can shut that down, hence shut the whole team down as far as offensively?
Yes and
no.
No. Yeah.
But he can shut himself down. If he has a bad game, they'll go out.
Yeah.
But I think his, one, the level he's performed at fairly consistently over the year.
Without a doubt.
And two, I don't think anyone else has that guy.
Yeah, I agree. Sounders LAFC would be a really interesting matchup, just in terms of a team that could slow them down with personnel. But Dallas could too.
Little remarks, say a little.
Yeah. All right, let's get to the Eastern Conference. We started in the West, but the match that was on Wednesday night that rounded out the second round of matches here in round one was New England Philadelphia. Philly 1-0 winners. Chris Donovan with the winner. Have to start with the huge news here. Kai Wagner has been suspended for 3 games, including this match. MLS issued a 3-match suspension to Wagner for violating the league's on-field anti-discrimination policy during the Union Revs match on Saturday, October 28th. It goes without saying. You've heard us say it on this show. It should just be blindingly obvious. Racism, any context, any time, any place, no matter the situation, wrong. Unacceptable. This was wrong and unacceptable. Kai Wagner is paying the price for that, for his actions, for his words. He did come out and apologize, accept responsibility. That doesn't change what he did, what he said on the field. So he gets the 3 games. He will miss potentially up to the conference final for the Union. It feels like we just are repeating the same thing, because on this show we've done this many times in many different contexts, whether it be around the protests that we saw in 2020 or otherwise. You know, this is not a soccer MLS problem. It's just a societal illness, and it's not gone, and it's still here, and it's always popping up, and we just got to find a way to fight it together. And the starting point of that is just saying, hey, this is wrong. It's unacceptable. That is what it is. Kyle Wagner is out for reasons that we understand and think are wrong. That does change things for the Union. Not having Jakub Glesnes changes things for the Union. Not having Julian Carranza changes things for the Union. They had a pretty... their quality was chipped away in this match. No doubt about it. And it looked that way but they were able to negate the quality on the other side because Carlos Hill started and was effective in moments, but was not his normal self. Gustavo Bow really wasn't effective. Thomas Chonklai had those moments where, like, oh my God, this guy is amazing, but never the final moment. And then it was Chris freaking Donovan that did get that moment, and the Union move on. And this felt inevitable given the Revs season. Everything that's happened for them in terms of injuries, in terms of Bruce Arena and the fallout after that, and the just disintegration of form and confidence that they seem to go through. Whereas Philadelphia are old hands in this moment and just sort of handled it.
Yeah, there was kind of no doubt amongst us last week when we were talking about it. And a lot of it comes down to just the Revs have not been the same team since August when they had to suspend Bruce Arena and then parted ways with him. And Omar Gonzalez came out in postgame yesterday and said as much. I think he went on for about 6 minutes, giving his perspective on all that. Our friend Seth McCumber has it on his Twitter feed. It's worth going and listening to all that. They never figured out how to play after Bruce was gone. Like, first Richie Williams and then Clint Pea tried to solidify that central midfield. It didn't work. And in part, it didn't work because they were suddenly losing so many other players. Like, Henry Kessler had not been fit basically all year. Brandon Bye gets hurt. Barrero gets hurt. And Barrero was the key to making that narrow diamond work. And the narrow diamond is why they had such good stability and why they were on like a 65 point pace through, you know, middle of July or whatever it was. And so they were vulnerable. It was there for the taking, and Philly were not good, and they were certainly not complete. But when McGlynn gets on the ball all the time, that allows Gazdag to play higher. So there's just a third guy in the box that Philly always has, and that puts the Revs on the back foot, and that tilts the pitch, and suddenly the Union start playing downhill. And the Union, when they play downhill, they generate chances and they generate set pieces, and you like their chances of putting away one or the other, and they eventually did. And that's all I really want to say about this game, because it was ugly and the Revs were a dead team walking, and the Union are going to go into the next round against Cincinnati as underdogs, but they know how to win games when they're underdogs.
Was it a red card on Marc-Anthony Kay? Did you agree with that decision?
I think it's not a hard one to make because the contact exists. And I think Clint Pea said after the game as much of, like, if he stomped on, he said, I hadn't seen it, so right. I can't totally speak. But what was explained to me was like, yeah, if you think that happened, then it's a red card. I can understand the complaint of, like, he's trying to find his balance. He's trying to find his space to put a foot down. But I'm not surprised.
I mean, Gazdag is, I think, intentionally trying to trip him up and get in his way. And if you're Marc-Anthony Kay in that point,
he's frustrated.
Yeah.
No, understandably
very
so.
Very frustrated. Just go down.
Yeah.
Fall down.
His momentum is taking him over. You would think that momentum would mean that you would pull that left foot and step over. I think that left foot goes back against the momentum, back into Gazdag. I think he just got frustrated and annoyed. And the game had been chippy for about 5 minutes before that and had been ramping up. And the Revs had ramped up some of the rhetoric beforehand. Matt Polster had said, maybe we should target their number 10 after Carlos Hill got targeted in the first game. So I just think it was a moment where Marc-Anthony Kay just kind of lost his composure a little bit and was frustrated and said, I'm going to get this guy a little bit. Do I think it was excessive force in terms of like violent conduct? No, but I think it's brutality when you step on somebody on the field in studs in their torso when it looks to me like your intent was to do that.
Yeah.
He reacted. Out of anger and lost his head in that moment for sure.
Here's a funny quote from Jim Curtin. I think this was in reference to the Polster quote. For the young guys, do your talking on the field and stay humble. It seems like we have a lot of instances now where players like to talk before the games, even ones who don't have an impact in the match. Jim out here firing away.
And then the Red Bulls caught astray.
Yeah.
In that extended
now,
quote.
Jim, I encourage you.
He loves a scoreboard He's got a couple of years of scoreboards where because let's be real, Jim's one of the more open people in MLS, and he has spoken like this a lot from back in the day to now. And now he's like, oh, you're going to say that? Scoreboard.
I love that he does this. I also would encourage all young guys / anyone to talk your talk. Like, please do so. I will happily listen / read those quotes, and it'll make things spicier. I do want to congratulate Chris Donovan on a Philly hero moment for a Philly guy that wasn't a Union homegrown.
Second best co-op in the country, Drexel behind Northeastern.
Oh, nice.
Okay.
He was a 4-year Drexel Dragon.
Yeah.
He was drafted by the Crew, 68th overall, cut in preseason, signed to Union 2. The last game he played before this playoff game was for Union 2 in MLS Next Pro. He comes off the bench and scores a goal on a set piece to win the game.
It's awesome.
Dope story.
It's also funny because Ernst Tanner skips the draft every year and doesn't
care
about the draft.
Okay, so let's just look ahead for the Union. Would you have worry here for them? We talked about this maybe being a final open window with maybe Glesnes going.
Are we doing Wagner? Are we doing Cincinnati talk here? Are we Carranza? Just talking Philly in a vacuum?
Let's wait on the conference first. Let me first look at if we talked about the Cincy game in a little more detail. So let's just do Philly in a vacuum. Carranza didn't play because of the hamstring. Glesnes probably won't be available for the conference semi. Certainly Wagner will not be. Yep. Wagner's their best chance creator by the numbers.
Jose Martinez came off with what looked like a hamstring injury.
El Bruno.
Brujo.
Yeah, I know, but that was a bad pun joke. Oh, no. El Bruno. All right, continue on.
Wow.
What just happened? Roll. Also, there's a guy on the team named Jesus Bueno, so you could have just
That's a good point.
gone with no,
no
Bueno.
No Bueno. Yeah, well, no. All of this is being workshopped into the
Live.
6 feet underground.
The Live. Union don't look anywhere near as good as they were this time last season. The injuries are a huge part of that, and the absences. I thought Andre Blake had himself a pretty good game, which we haven't seen a lot of from him down the stretch. They'll need him to be very good. They'll go into the next round being, I think, I don't say prohibitive, but like certainly underdogs. However, since he's going to be shorthanded.
Right, they're shorthanded.
I don't know how we're doing this without talking Cincy.
We were talking about it before, all the injuries that the Union have. Cincinnati's going to have a lot of players out too. It's kind of one of those where, yes, Cincinnati will be the favorites, but anything can kind of happen in this type of game.
It'll come down a lot to, like, if Carranza's back, that's massive. And that will change a lot. And there's a long layoff for Carranza to get back from game one all the way through of this round, all the way through to the next round. I thought in game one, in the opening 30 minutes, you saw what Philly was aiming for, which was let's peak in the playoffs. Let's not get to the playoffs tired. I thought you saw that. I think from that moment on, you saw a team sort of play disinterested, kind of knowing it was over. And that's not a positive, but I would be shocked if they played that way in a one-game elimination against FC Cincinnati. You go back to last year's playoff game. You go to Pat Noonan and Chris Albright and Jim Curtin. There's a lot that will be going on for this game before it kicks off.
Interestingly, the only win for Philadelphia head-to-head against Cincy since Noonan and Albright went to Cincy was that playoff win. There's 4 regular season games, 2 Cincy it's wins,
good,
2 draws.
It's a good one to put all your chips in that basket.
Yeah, no doubt. Let's Red Bull Eggs, Cincy. Chips. Do we have anything else to add to this game? I mean, other than just sort of the pure Red Bullsian way that it all went down. I mean, blowing a 1-0 lead, Andres Reyes losing his mind on a free kick at midfield and basically like wall passing it off a Cincinnati just player to have it stuffed
moment.
Down their throat. Like that just made no sense in the moment.
I thought Pupenza was very good off the bench. I don't think at any point this year will he be fully integrated to, I think he's going to be special next year. Like it's just going to take a little while, but I don't think Cincinnati has looked good in the playoffs. So when you ask from Philly's point of view, we don't make the mistakes New York makes. How are they creating chances right now? Because that's really what it fell to over the course of this series for Cincinnati. And then now you throw on Matt Miazga and Nick Hagelin are out. So this team either has to change their formation for the first time all year, or they have to play Ray Gattis or Alvis Powell at center back, and they have to probably move Mascara into the middle, or maybe you move Ian Murphy, whatever you choose. I thought Murphy was bad in this game. He struggled in possession, and he struggled out of possession. And so you look at a team that won Supporters Shield that's going in from a strength to now potentially a weakness, and then what's the knock-on effect of like how that affects Barrial's spacing? How high up on the field does he play? Do you start Arias? Do you start Ray Gattis as a safe move? Nwobodo came off hurt as well pretty early in this game. He is critical to their defensive structure. So I think since I feel less confident about FC Cincinnati right now winning MLS Cup because they are going into a single elimination game with a hand behind their back with a ton of big pieces missing.
Yeah, but they still have probably the three most talented players on the field in Lucho, Bupenza, and Barrial. Maybe four if Noboto is good to go, and they're at home. And we saw in that Red Bull, you're right, they didn't play great. They didn't play badly against the Red Bulls. And the Red Bulls are a tough team to play against. And the playoffs tend to be about, can you limit the quality of the chances you allow, and can you punish mistakes? And while I don't think that anybody on Philly is going to ping a quick free kick off the nearest defender for absolutely no reason, it's not like Philly played mistake-free soccer against the Revs, and the Revs are not a good team right now. So, since they are favorites in this one, I expect them to go through. It's MLS, though, and the Union have a lot of equity with people who watch the playoffs, so nobody would be surprised if Philly pulled off an upset here.
There is a question as to Miazga's long-term status.
Let's cross that bridge when we get to it, man. Oof.
There is. You can go read the news. They've got it all across the MLS world, so you can go check that out. What about the Red Bulls? Is there more to this club than early playoff exits?
Yeah. I mean, go ahead, Doyle.
I wrote about this in the post-mortem. I do think it's time to interrogate the game model. Because the game model works in the regular season. We've seen that, right? But it works in Salzburg, where Salzburg can spend two or three times the amount of money on players on that roster that anybody else in Austria can. But what we've seen from Leipzig is that they don't do the full-on murder ball that Red Bull was famous for 10 years ago that got them to the Bundesliga in the first place. And because there's a point of diminishing returns on playing that type of soccer, you need to actually be able to build chances. So they have dialed back that press a bit. Nagelsmann was the one who really did that for them. But then when Jesse Marsch went to Leipzig, he tried to reinstitute that, and the players sort of rebelled. They didn't buy into it. So I think what we've seen here is that we've reached the point of diminishing returns with this type of soccer. And even if they go out and they add two $10 million forwards this offseason, then I like their chances next year. But unless they do that, I think they have to play a little bit more. And I don't think it's a coincidence that Philadelphia, who have a similar budget to Red Bull, maybe even less, used to, like 3 years ago, they tried to play that same exact type of high pressing, high line, energy drink soccer, and that got them the Sporter Shield in an early exit from the playoffs. And since then, they have dropped that line. They play more through midfield. They use the ball a little bit more. I think that is a key thing for the decision makers at Red Bull to understand going into 2024. And if they don't, I expect it'll be the same thing next year. They'll probably end up with 7-8 more points in the regular season, maybe get a home game, so that they are home field advantage, so they go around further in the playoffs, but there's not going to be a cup.
Is Troy Lesane the coach of this team next year? Just yes or no. We don't got to dig in.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. Nashville, Orlando City. Orlando swept it. 2-1-0 wins. Nashville go out with a whimper again. Same story as last year against the Galaxy. Just couldn't create chances. Couldn't finish when they had half chances. Bummer.
To be clear, there were full chances in game one.
Yes, there were.
And they were to Sam Surridge. Yeah. And Teal Bunbury.
Yes.
But I think the big part is they went out to spend the money on Sam Surridge so he would score that goal, and then they would be tied 1-1.
Is that on Sam Surridge, or is that on it taking until the summer in the middle of your sort of trophy window to go get Sam Surridge? I mean, he almost got it done for them in the League's Cup. It just didn't happen in the final. Came up against Messi.
I mean, Bupenza scored.
That's
for
fair.
Cincinnati to get to the next
but
round.
The other thing is, he only got one chance. Like, we're talking about through two games, like two chances basically that were good chances.
That's why they signed him.
It's a small sample size with Surridge because he was injured, because he was out for so long. The moments that were good were pretty good. I liked the combination that he had with Hani, and the couple times where we saw it, we were able to see it. I thought it was positive. It didn't look like same old Nashville, same old, brutal Nashville to watch. Sometimes apologize for that, but it's the truth.
True.
And we saw it creep back in again, and he really didn't get that many opportunities. Yes, he missed one really bad one in game one, But I feel like he still deserves a little bit more of a shot to get that spot, I think, next season.
There's a guy I know that has a theorem that I think applies here.
It could, yeah, especially when you've got lads and mates
working
together. Now, I will say this about this team. To your point, obviously they're going to keep Sam. Like, that's not the question. I would say, in my mind, they have a profile in Schaffelberg. Pico sort of fits it as well, of like someone who works hard, runs, covers space. Alex Mwheel, a grinder. It's supposed to fall on Randall Leal to be like the guy who can unlock a defense. I don't think Randall Leal is that guy. I don't think it's been proven.
So I think that's unfair to say that he should be doing that.
That's where they could spend money. And you could say, you don't have to step away from everything that's made you good, but there needs to be someone.
There needs to be more. There needs to be more playmaking out of midfield. I think even more crucial than that, though, is they need one of those central midfielders, one of the defensive midfielders, to step into Dax's shoes and be able to progress the ball quickly up. All this stuff I was talking about Ilya doing for LAFC, Dax is the one who does that for Nashville. And unfortunately, he had a terrible game in this one. He's also 36 years old. Sean Davis is a good player, but he does not pass the ball like that. So especially if you're going to be a pure counterattacking team, which we all know for as long as Gary Smith is there.
I was just going to ask you, you said the Rebels need to find a tweak on their identity. Isn't that true of Nashville?
No, I don't think so. I think if they can upgrade some of the personnel, they can still be who they are and be successful.
The Rebels don't have somebody of Hani Mukhtar's quality.
That's fair. Or Surge.
Or Walker Zimmerman's.
Yeah, that's...
So
I don't love the game model. I think it invites too much pressure, and I think it does it in a way where if you're a forward and you miss that first big chance, that stays with you because you're like, I'm not getting another.
Right.
I think, like, it's an increasingly universal game, right? And the best teams are all their styles are all starting to meld and look a little bit alike. So outliers like Red Bull or in the other direction, Nashville have like kind of an advantage, but if you can't carry the game with the ball for at least small chunks of time, then you're in trouble. And what set Nashville apart in the League's Cup was they were carrying the game with the ball. Mm-hmm. I remember in that final against Miami came upfield three times and tried to press them, and Nashville looked like freaking Barcelona playing through that press. It was unbelievable. That was gone.
But playing through pressure is different than instigating the game when Orlando sits
off. That's fair.
And that's, I don't think playing through pressure is their issue. But I think MLS is a little different, where I think your style can get you a little bit further if you are different than other teams, because there's a pretty high floor where teams are similar because of salary cap and the way rosters are built. And so for Nashville, like, they will continue to be somewhat successful. They made a cup final. They made the playoffs. And whether you want to say you should be higher than seventh where they finished?
Seventh.
Fine. But I think a lot of that was like the energy they put into League's Cup.
I mean, Gary Smith, he said they peaked too early.
Yeah. Which is fine.
They'll be fine if Hani is an MVP quality attacker, right?
But
that's sort of the truth here, right?
But they don't want to be fine. They want to be.
What I'm saying.
Well, there's other ways to find support. The big one that I've hit on this a bunch, they've not pretty much hit on any outside of MLS acquisitions except Hani Mukhtar, even Shaq Moore.
Yeah.
Shaq Moore was like a multi-million dollar acquisition for them. He played in one
that
cross.
That Alistair Johnson made way
this
for.
He played in one cross this whole series. Like, that's just, and so he doesn't affect the game. And that's supposed to be like, if we sit in and we push one fullback high, they have to be a bit of a difference maker. And so there are little spots there where I think this team can improve without stepping away from who they are and be more successful than where they're at. But it will probably cost money, and they will have to do something they've not done before, which is hit on international signings.
Orlando
Although
City.
Diego Rubio is an interesting one here. So maybe it'll be an MLS signing.
That could be. Are Orlando City boring? Are they playoff pragmatic?
I think they were playoff pragmatic against Nashville. And it goes back to what we were saying about them heading into the playoffs. It's not that they're incredibly great at any one thing. It's that they're bad at nothing, and they just don't give you the types of turnovers that we've seen decide other series. They're tough to beat on set pieces, even though they're not great in the air. It's like this weird dichotomy. And going forward, Angulo will press you. You know, he will turn your bad pass into a goal. I thought he was really good linking play and occupying those center backs. I wanted to see more from Facu Torres. I wanted to see more from Mauricio Pereira. But the way this team is built, they can survive a round or two of the playoffs without those two guys being incredible.
And I think the other opponents coming up fit the way they want to play now, which is like there's no decision. Yeah. They're going to sit in. You're going to want the ball. And they're going to try and hit you where they hit you. And I think it'll actually be more comfortable for them.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. I think those results, the 2-1 nils, it's more of a product of just how Nashville does their business, right? And how they handle their games more to them what Orlando could provide in a game against a better matchup. So, yeah, it was basically what I was going to say. Same thing.
All right. We'll keep it moving on that one.
Are Orlando favorites in the East given Cincinnati's missing pieces?
I have to see what Columbus looks like in game 3.
Okay.
Fair.
Okay. But being home and then Cincinnati missing pieces potentially longer.
Also been the best team in the league for the past 3 months in terms of points per game.
It's not a ridiculous.
No. They finished second. I know. Yeah.
Let's do the game 3s. Let's keep it to game 3 and what you're looking for with like a little wrap on game 2, just because we'll have another chance to hit these next week. And we'll also hit all the off-season odds and ins and the head coaches. Yeah, Maria's getting a little impatient with us. FC Dallas, Seattle Sounders, Friday, 10 p.m. Eastern, right after Noche Door. What are you looking for, Dave? What did Dallas do right to get this to game 3?
They played with energy. They played with urgency. They played direct. I think Kamungo fits all of that better. Not better, but having him in the team, even though you've lost Velasco, makes them a little bit better. And I sort of asked, I think on this show last week, was like, do we just not have no expectations for Paul Areola? And we talked about him a little bit, and he played a ton of soccer in this game, and he just has it. He has stayed out wide and tried to be a runner on the back post and work hard defensively, and he comes inside, and he creates overloads, and he helps the team. And his goal,
the best goal that Dallas scored all season.
And he comes from an inside position, and you watch the goal, and it's João Paulo passes him off because he doesn't really know whose responsibility it is, and Reagan doesn't even recognize that he goes past him. And so Kamungo sees the space, and credit to Paul Areola, he doesn't try and do too much.
Yeah.
He can sense the cross. He's like, I just need to nod this forward. Then you get the opening goal, and I think that takes a lot of pressure off the team. They get the PK. Jesus gets to put one in the net as well. I think you could see in his celebration sort of what it means. All of that went well for them. And the baseline for this team is they are one of the best defenses. So they're going to be in every game if they can score goals. And I think you see that confidence after taking a 2-0 lead. They shift a little bit. They play a little bit deeper. But I would expect that they come into this game, and Nico Estevez will say, we should have been up 1-0 in game 1. We won the second game 3-1. Like, we belong here. We're good enough. We can play with this team. And it'll be interesting to see where they step off and where they choose to press and what the triggers are and where the trap is, because they were able to create those two chances in the first game, which maybe were out of character for Seattle. Maybe they weren't. But I think for Dallas, every player will have a belief that if we execute our game plan, we have a chance to go through to the next round. And that's not always the case when you go on the road in an MLS playoff game.
RSL always has belief. They rekindled it in game 2. Doyle, we're going to watch game 3 on Saturday at 6 p.m. Eastern time back in Houston. I don't think it would be wise for RSL to shift all the way back to, we only want 25% of the ball. We only are going to counterattack. They changed this series, I think, by ratcheting up the intensity level and desire to be around the ball and disrupt Houston's passing patterns and disrupt Ace Ace. How does Pablo approach game 3? What's the key?
X-Dog? Yeah, like it's always impossible to say with RSL. I think of it more in terms of Houston. Like, this game, just like game 1, was everything that we see about Houston that makes us feel like they're MLS Cup dark horse contenders, and everything about Houston that makes them dark horses and not favorites. Because was it early in the second half, they had a break where it was Quiñones down the left and Baird up, and like Quiñones did not have to go offside, but he left early, takes a step offside, and Baird, like, he flubs the finish anyway.
Yeah, Baird missed the chance that ended up not mattering.
It wasn't as bad as the Jean De Silva chance, but it was a bad.
The ball did. It looked like the ball bobbled just a little bit, but that's excuse.
But these
making.
Are like
that's, I know it's excuses.
These are the moments.
A bobble.
these are the moments that Houston have to put teams away, and I still am not convinced that they're going to do it throughout the playoffs. Now, I do think that they'll take care of business against RSL. How RSL tries to disrupt that, how to change that, I mean, they're going to stay with the 4-4-2. You know, they're going to bring Luna in off that left midfield and, like, essentially create a lopsided midfield triangle, and then whoever's on the right wing, it tries to extend the field, and Severino plays as kind of a second forward. So you end up having these little triangles.
Chicho start?
I assume so.
The game completely changed, like, tenor.
Yep.
Tactically, when he came on, it was like a different feel.
If you have a choice to make, because he might not be 90 minutes fit, bring him on as a sub. Do you start him if he can only play 60 minutes?
I think I hate putting out a lineup where you know you're going to have to make a change. But I think this is one where if you can play your best player for 60 minutes, you get him out there for 60 minutes. The other thing is, like, okay, if you're playing for 60, okay, maybe you try to sneak into halftime at 0-0.
I think that's the other idea, which is if you can hold the fort early,
right,
pressure builds on Houston, and he comes off. The other thing I throw in there, and I think this is even stupid for considering, Anderson Julio is a terrible starter, and he's a game-changing sub. So if you start Chicho and you bring Julio off the bench, you put him in a more comfortable position. I don't think you plan any of this around Anderson Julio. It's just a reality. Chicho Arango, though, coming off the bench in this game, just showed you why he's not a pure goal scorer. Like, he does more for this team. He created chances. He was a reference point for them to play off of. He made Diego Luna's life easier. Like, they are two different teams with or without him. That was evident from this game, just from the moments he was on the field and the moments he wasn't.
And to put a number on it, like, RSL over the final 20 minutes of that game when Chicho Arango came on were around 65% possession. So it was the complete opposite of game one.
If it goes to penalties, it feels like Zach McMath has a big advantage over Steve Clark.
What do you do with Amin Bassi? Oh, six for six on penalties this season. He missed two in this game.
Well, he had one. Yeah, he had one. He
did both saved.
One saved, it. And then he cast the rebound. Penalty. Yeah, for sure, for sure.
I thought it was a good finish off the miss.
Of course. Yeah.
Great. He missed two penalties.
I like Zach McMath was like, my wife helped me decide to stay down the middle. I like that.
Did he say that?
Yeah.
I didn't see that.
Yeah.
Got some brownies.
Just like getting points that didn't even.
I know.
She's like, we've literally never talked about this before. You're lying.
We have now.
Yeah. Right.
We have now. Yeah, that was tough. That was tough. But Steve Clark didn't look like he troubled.
Knew
no. any of the RSL takers.
No, not really.
So I'd be curious to see how this one ends, but it's been a fun series.
I thought so Nelson Palacio was massive in this game in like changing the energy. He played a little bit higher. I think he steps in and fouls a Houston centerman. Maybe it was Arthur, like in the opening 30 seconds, high up the field. And it's like
they had to disrupt that part of the
right.
Field.
It's not going to be easy.
He was behind the play on the goal, though.
Yes.
And the like leading to the penalty.
And he came off hurt.
Yeah.
So I think that's a big question mark for them. They got Glad back, who gave up the penalty. But
that was tough. That was a terrible tackle.
Yeah. I thought you meant it was a tough call.
No.
Because he thought it was a tough
easy
call when it
call.
Happened. It's like,
yeah. Anyway. All right. That's on Saturday at 6 p.m. Atlanta United Columbus Crew finish up round one on Sunday at 7 p.m. Eastern. This one's going to have goals. It's going to be entertaining. Thiago Almada is back. The Crew kind of got punched in the mouth, Steph.
Yep.
What do you see?
I mean, the biggest change was, like we mentioned earlier, Thiago Almada being back just puts Atlanta in a place where they can play all their guys where they want to play all their guys, completely opposite of what we saw in game one against Columbus. I think that this potentially could be, and I don't think I'm breaking any news here, but the most fun game. I think Atlanta is going to come out with all the momentum coming off of that game at home, playing the way they want to play with the players in the positions that they want to be in. Yakumakis, Silva, doing what they do, Lobogenitze as well, and Almada in the middle. It's set up for a game where Atlanta can truly come out and put a lot of pressure on Columbus, who's going to have more pressure now, because Columbus is, all season long, we've considered them favorites, one of the more entertaining teams to watch all season long. They have defensive issues. They've had those defensive issues all season long. They didn't really need a whole lot of defense in game one. They really needed it in game two. Didn't come out. They get four goals scored on them. I love this game. I think it's going to be so fun. I have the crew winning the cup in my bracket, so it's a big one for as far as I'm concerned. But I think that this has a potential to be fireworks. Going back to Columbus, Almada playing with that much confidence, Cucho doing his thing. He's arguably been the most incredible striker that we've seen in this last, I don't know, month of the season. So I think that this is going to be really, really, really fun.
One loss at home all year for the crew.
Yep. Yeah. Yep. I think Atlanta was great. I have trouble imagining them beating the crew twice in a row anywhere, let alone going to Ohio in a must-win game. Aiden Morris isn't going to be that poor defensively again. I think Wilfred Nancy will figure out something to open up that right wing a little bit more, because Julian Gressel didn't have much of an impact on the game, which was surprising to me. And we've said it, like, the best teams that have the best player tend to advance. Thiago Amada was so good the other day. Right now, though, I would still take Cucho.
Yeah. I think Nonce can come out of game two and say, like, if we put away our chances, we win.
Yeah.
And it's the same as game one. And I think what they would say,
Atlanta's going to give up two big chances in the first 15
minutes. And they would say, over three games, we think we'll finish enough that we'll win the series.
Yeah.
And that's sort of the bet now we're in. And so I think Nonce sticks to everything. I would be surprised if Yaya Boa doesn't start.
Yeah.
Same. Of like, he's going to say, let's just put all the pressure.
Well, especially because if you look at Atlanta's shape, Brooks Lennon is either up or in.
Right.
Right. So your left back can, like, that's a lot of runway for your left wing back if you're playing, you know.
And it seems like Rosetto won't play. So there's even less possession potentially in midfield for Atlanta. And it's like Columbus, I think, is going to say, let's take the game. Let's try and play them off the field in the opening 20 minutes.
Dave, we were talking about this on the preview, how, like, Thiago being there allows the wing backs to do what they do, to go up that. That's also going to allow opportunities going the other way, because regardless of whether they have to come back or not, try back, when you have guys like Diego Rossi being able to just run on the break, Cucho obviously doing what he does, we saw him score a goal from running from midfield, so there are clearly going to be an opportunity. That's just, it's just going to be such a fun game. Do I think the crew will win this game? Absolutely. Do I think it could easily be a really tight game? Absolutely.
100%. I think Atlanta, the two wingers exposed the 1v1 defensive issues for a lot of the guys that play in the crew backline. We don't even know who they'll be in this game, because, like, they have options. None of them are elite at that. And that will always be the case. Almada is elite. Yakumakis is, like, yes. If Atlanta wins this game, I think we could all see the formula of how it happens and wouldn't be shocked. But Columbus will be heavy favorites.
I hope it's a 5-4 game. That's what I want.
Three more matches in the first round. All of them promising to be good. Friday, Saturday, Sunday. So a pretty good lineup to end this round. You got one match a night, then go do your thing. Enjoy all the coverage on MLS Season Pass, pregame shows, postgame shows. It's all there. Go check out the wrap-up if you want all the highlights from last night leading into the weekend, with some previews there as well. We will tackle next week, because we're going to hit the international break, a bunch of off-season stuff, in particular coaching changes around MLS. Technically 8 jobs open. I kind of would call it 6 with 2 interims because of Troy Lesane and Frank Klopas. As I said, Minnesota, Chicago, New England, DC, Colorado, and Charlotte and Montreal now. Yeah. So that might
Has it been reported that Frank Klopas is the favorite to keep the Chicago job?
No. I'm just saying it.
Are you breaking news?
I'm not. I'm just saying because they're interim, and I haven't heard them say, hey, they're not interims. Right. And I haven't heard any news.
I think it's safe
There's been no, like, Chicago didn't come out and be like, we're looking for a new head coach.
Yeah.
Or we're in the interview process.
I think it's safe to assume the 3 interims that are left, with Miles Joseph having already not gotten the job over Phil Neville, that the person in the job, well, I guess I'm not including the Revs there. The person in the job, I think, is the front runner in my mind to keep that job. Montreal is fascinating. I don't know what you thought you were getting from Losada, and I don't know what you thought you were going to do this year. I think from a performance point of view, they probably finished where you'd expect.
Yep.
From a style point of view, it was different than Nancy.
Yeah, right.
If you didn't know that when you hired Losada.
If you thought you were continuing the Nancy project with Hernan, you just didn't watch him in D.C. And he played very similar to how he played in D.C. So, I don't know. Going back to the drawing board, we'll hit all that. We'll talk Chicharito. He parted ways with the Galaxy, but somebody should probably sign him in MLS, or at least consider that strongly. Minnesota has a sporting director, but not until the summer. Very strange. This is the MLS offseason.
Feels like they'll figure out a buyout on that one, right?
Yeah, you would. The pressure's on for that, I guess.
Yeah.
All right, that's it for us, though. Enjoy these final three games. We'll be back next week to wrap it up and push the conversation ahead. Enjoy your weekend, everybody. Adios.